Good morning. We're going to continue our series today based on the little book that's been available to you, I Am a Church Member. And we are going to do it a little bit of out of order today because of what happened last week. Last week we had intermission in our series on church membership and experienced something I thought very special that, first of all, I got to sit in a pew and not do anything for a Sunday, and that was kind of cool for me. I don't do that very often. And come to find out, when I don't do anything, the service goes better. So it was a wonderful morning. We got to hear mothers praying for mothers. We got to hear, see the joy on the faces of parents with young children and babies that we got to bless and pray over. And we got to see our young men leading in various capacities in worship. And just, it was the whole life of a family in a church on display in one session. Every phase and episode of life on display. And so I was looking at the lesson I was supposed to follow it with, and I realized that if I rearranged it a little bit, I would get to talk about families today as a follow-up to that. And so that's what I'm going to do. We're actually going to talk about the fifth chapter of the book, which asks the question, what role does church membership play in my family? Or you could ask it the other way around, in what way does my family relate to my church and church membership? What's the connection between those two ideas, those two institutions? And I think in my head, there's a perfect answer to that, and then there's the answer I probably actually ought to give. And they're not exactly the same, and that's the struggle for every one of us. In fact, reading the little book that we've talked about repeatedly, this chapter was the one that I struggled with the most because it almost was such an idealized version of what should happen, it wasn't applicable to any actual family or any actual church that I knew. And that's the struggle, I think, for us. That when we talk about family, when I say family and church, we immediately start imagining perfect families and perfect churches, of which we have neither. Joshua 24 and verse 15 is the passage that has kind of lived in my head anytime I think about my role as a father and in my family and in my home. This is at the end of the life of Joshua, his parting words, "And if it is evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day who you will serve, whether the gods your father served in the region beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." In my head, there is this little group of people called the Williams family, and we are committed to God, and we will be a building block around which the church will be built, and we have this decisive claim that we will follow God no matter what. And to a degree, I believe that's a great goal that all of us should have. I want it to be true in my family. That's a verse I think about quite often. But again, I think you know in the life of actual family, there's the ideal. And then there's the reality. There is what God drew up when he created man and woman in a garden long ago, when he instituted marriage and did what he did. And then there is what we have made of it through the centuries and what we're doing with it in the particular cases of our families today. And I want to talk about both of those because both of them matter. Speaking of the ideal, we would probably want to look at such passages as Ephesians 5 and Ephesians 6. I'm not going to read all of it to you today, but it's one of the various passages in the New Testament called the Household Codes. By the way, I'm fighting a summer head cold, so Household Codes is very hard for me to say. I practiced it this morning. Got through it. The Household Codes are passages that outline the ideal of what God intended for the family. They're based roughly on Genesis, on the picture of creation. In fact, anytime Paul talks about the family, he starts quoting from Genesis. He does it in Ephesians 5. He does it in 1 Timothy chapter 2. Anytime he starts talking about family, he starts talking about Genesis because he says there is the way God drew it up. In Ephesians 5 and 6, he talks about husbands and wives in chapter 5. How the husband, he opens up the section by saying, let everyone submit to one another. Submitting to one another. And then he says, and here's how it's going to work. The husband is going to be the head of the wife in the way that Christ is the head of the church. He's going to be this self-sacrificing, life-giving leader in his home. Life is going to flow out of him and his sacrifice. He will have zero selflessness in his choices and his actions and his service. He will be continually looking to the needs of his wife and his family. And the wife will be devoted to her husband and to her family as the church is devoted to Christ. And because of the character of each, that relationship will not be a burden or a chain, but will be a blessing that flows into each family. And then he keeps going. In chapter 6, if you thought, well, that was idealistic, chapter 6 gets better. Chapter 6, Paul says, and the children will obey their parents. And that's when I realize, he's making stuff up. No. The children will obey their parents, and they'll honor them and be respectful to them. And fathers will not provoke their children to wrath, but will lead them to know God in all their ways. That's the ideal. And again, I'm not actually mocking it. Sometimes I sound a little cynical. I don't want to mock it because that's the way God drew it up, and that is what every one of us needs to be aiming for. Not only is what we're aiming for, it is an integral part of what God is doing in his church. My favorite part of that section is chapter 5, verse 32, where he says, "This mystery is profound, and I am saying that it refers to Christ in the church." Verse after verse after verse about husband and wife, and he says, but here's the riddle, here's the mystery. The family is going to help you understand the church, and the church is going to help you understand the family. The family is going to help you build a church, and the church is going to help you build a family. And these two principles are so interconnected, so that you can't speak about one without the other. When you start talking about one, you don't know when you stopped talking about it and just suddenly started talking about the other. They're ideas that are so connected, one simply flows into the other. So what's the ideal? The ideal for your family is something that you should have in your head. What do I want for my family? How does it relate to my church? I want a family that's praying together as a family, that spends time regularly together in prayer. I want a family that's worshiping together, that regularly and consistently comes together as a family and worships God. And I want a family that's serving together, that is regularly and consistently lifting up the strength that they have and offering it to others in the name of God and to God's glory as a family. That's the ideal, and that's what we long for. And I was kind of tempted to just stop the sermon there, but as ever I do, I found more to say. Because in reality, we know that the reality of the modern family doesn't always look like that. The modern family is more often characterized by confusion, isolation, and messiness. There are circumstances, I have a good minister friend who likes to use the expression, "What a stupid time to be alive." And what he means by that is, it seems like some of these things we expected when we got into ministry didn't quite play out the way that we were expecting. Some of them are kind of neutral and neither good nor bad. Millennials are getting married later in life than their parents or the parents before them did. And so that's just kind of a unique little set of circumstances that we have to reckon with. For the first time in American history, a few years ago, it became the case that there were more unmarried persons in America than there were married persons. Okay, that was the first time that had happened since our founding. That was unusual, unexpected. And that's just the kind of stuff I know how to get my head around. I'm not trying to give you a shock headline here or anything, but just a few years ago, for the first time in my life, a young Christian woman came to me and said, "I have a question about marriage." And I said, "Oh, good. I've prepared for these. I know all about them." And she says, "My husband has decided that he is in fact a woman and is changing his gender. What does the Bible tell me to do in my marriage in this situation?" And I said, "We didn't cover that one in Bible class." That was a circumstance, I mean, it just gut punched me, that I thought I had like mastered all the doctrines of marriage and everything I was supposed to know. And I did not even know where to begin having that conversation. The reality then is that quite often our families, rather than being this ideal, are confused, isolated, and messy. And the temptation is to say, as my friend says, what a stupid time to be alive. This has all come out of nowhere, and we're totally unprepared. But then I started reading my Bible and realized that actually, if you read the Bible, families, in different ways than maybe now, have always been confusing, messy places. For example, I said if you want to know about the family, you go to Genesis. Have you read Genesis? Have you ever drawn the family tree of Abraham and his family? Do you understand that the 12 tribes of Israel, Jacob has at least 13 children by four different women that we know of? Okay? Confusion in what the family should be is not new in that sense. Things have been messy. There was the ideal that God designed and said, this is what I want, strive towards that. And then all too often there has been our renditions of it that haven't matched up at all. In the time of Christ, in Matthew chapter 19, the Pharisees, and don't forget that, the Pharisees came to him and tested him by asking, is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? Okay. Two words I want you to notice in that sentence, Pharisee and any. The Pharisees are the religious conservatives of their day. Right? These aren't the wild-eyed progressives who are trying to change everything. These are the people who are trying to protect traditional Jewish values. And they come to Jesus and they say, what? Any. It's okay to divorce your wife for just about any reason, right? To which Jesus has to say, no, that's not at all what God had in mind. Not any reason. And he refers back to Genesis and they have a discussion about it. He acknowledges down in verse 9 that sometimes there are messy circumstances and divorce does take place. And he explains what Moses said in the Old Testament about that topic. But the point I want to make to you is that we're in the first century A.D., 2,000 years ago, and religious conservatives come to Jesus under the impression that maybe divorce for absolutely any reason was what God had in mind. Josephus, a first century Jewish historian, actually details the account of him divorcing his wife because of her cooking. Okay? Paul then takes the gospel to the city of Corinth. And if you thought the world we live in was strange, take a time machine to Corinth, and it gets stranger. And there Paul finds all manner of questions about marriage and family that he has to deal with. And some of them he can just give an answer to and say, remember what Jesus said. So for example, in 1 Corinthians 7, 10 and 11, to the married I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, she should remain married or else be reconciled to her husband, and the husband should not divorce his wife. And in that, he just basically repeats what Jesus had said in Matthew chapter 19. He says, I'm just going to tell you what Jesus said. But evidently, they had questions that Jesus hadn't covered in Bible class. And so in the very next verse, he says, to the rest, I say, I, not the Lord. What does that mean? It's Paul. I don't think it means I'm making this up as I go. I think he's still led by the Spirit. I think he's still an apostle, and you should read this as Scripture. But he is acknowledging Jesus never covered the next question. He didn't anticipate in speech the circumstance that you're asking me about in Corinth. You have messy situations in Corinth that Jesus never taught on in Palestine. He says, so to the rest, not the Lord, but me. Here's Paul adding some information for you. And he goes on in chapter 7, is a big, long, messy chapter where he tries to explain, here's what to do with the specific set of circumstances you have in your life in Corinth. What am I trying to say? Divorce, singleness, and even what we might call spiritual singleness, where a person in a family is not of the same convictions and goals for the family as their partner, it's not new to the church. It's not new to human history. The particular variation of it we see in the headlines is new to us today, but the idea that we have made something out of family God didn't intend, that's not new. That comes from Genesis. All the way down, these things have been with us from the beginning, and certainly from the beginning of the church. Jesus taught on it. He addressed it. Paul taught on it. He addressed it. Always there was a reality that this was present among us. So I say all that to say If we're going to think like Jesus and think like Paul, we have to address these topics the way he does. We welcome the mess without giving up the ideal. This is not a place where only perfect families are allowed. If it was, attendance would be quite a lot down, as in empty. If we said only perfect families need apply here, we wouldn't have anybody to talk to. We acknowledge the mess that comes with every family that walks through that door and the uniqueness of that mess, that your kind of mess is different than my kind of mess, and you think my mess is weird, and I think your mess is weird, and it is because you're weird. But we acknowledge that that's what walks through the door. At the same time, we refuse to give up the ideal. That we don't look at the world and say, what do we got? I guess that's what we're stuck with. What we do is we look at the world and say, here's who we are. What does God want to make of us? Where is God leading us? And where did he draw up a better blueprint than we have made? In all of human history, I don't know that we've ever once done precisely what God wanted for marriage. But I'll tell you this, in all of human history, we have not improved on it. Every variation we have introduced has made things worse, which is why when Jesus talks about marriage and the family, he says you need to remember what God did when he made you male and female. And when Paul talks about marriage and family, he says you need to remember what God did when he made you male and female. We have not improved on it. The idea of the home as God designed it is not an idea that has been tried and found wanting. It's been found difficult and left untried. And so as a church, our goal is to acknowledge and even welcome the mess. We be sinners here. But never to give up the ideal that God is drawing us upward to. And so in that same text, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul says it like this. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise, your children be unclean, but as it is, they're holy. It's a strange sentence because we don't think in those terms in that way of like which one of us makes the other holy. It's a very Jewish way of thinking about it, and it's very different to us. But the sentiment that he's expressing is actually very important. The question the Corinthian woman was asking was, is my family doomed because the person I'm married to doesn't share my Christian values? Am I, in fact, doomed because the person I'm married to doesn't share my Christian values? And Paul says, oh, that's one way to look at it, but that's not the right way to look at it. He says, because Christianity exists in you, it can exist in your family. That the influence can go the other way. You, today, are God's tool for holiness in your family. You, today, in whatever mess you find yourself in, are God's instrument for bringing his will more fully into your family. Yeah, but I'm not perfect. Yep, sign up. That's all of us. Yeah, but my spouse isn't perfect. My kids are a mess and everything. We've made these terrible mistakes. Doesn't matter. There is no story you could tell me that's any stranger than the ones Paul heard in Corinth. And he said, you today are God's instrument of holiness in your family. You are his tool for influence and for good. Peter says much the same thing. 1 Peter chapter 3, 1 and 2. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives when they see your respectful and pure conduct. He refers also to kind of the ideal, right? Wives subject to husbands, husbands selflessly leading their families, and that's in 1 Peter chapter 3. But right in the middle of that, as soon as he expresses the ideal, he says, but I know that some of you are struggling with that because some of your husbands aren't very good people. He says, don't fear. You can be the influence. You can be the tool, the agent, the instrument of good in that family by being what you're supposed to be there. That's your task. Your behavior in your family will shape their perception of Christianity, which brings us all the way back full circle to our question, what's the relationship between the family and my church membership and my church family? And the answer is, the way you treat one will influence the other. The way that you shape one will shape the other. You will be an influence in both. and your dedication to Christ will be a positive in both places, whether you see it every day or not. So I want to kind of conclude with this sentiment, this question for you to take home today, and then we'll do our final pledge as we have for each lesson in this series. I want to suggest to you that every family has a religion. The word religion comes from an old Latin word, religio, which didn't mean religion as a category, like Islam is a religion, Judaism is a religion, Christianity is. It wasn't a category word. It was a word that simply meant devotion. You are devoted to something. Write out every moment of your life in a journal and then read it. You have spent your life on something, and your family is at this very moment spending its life on something. Your family has a religion. The question you should ask is not, should we be religious or not? You are religious. You are devoted to something. The question is, what is your religion? What, when we read the pages of your family story, would we see written on those pages? What have you devoted yourself to? And that will make all the difference. So today we're going to conclude with our pledge. It's the fifth pledge in the fourth sermon because I'm just strange like that. But if you'd be standing, we're going to go ahead and say it together. The pledge is, I will lead my family to be healthy church members. Repeat it with me. I will lead my family to be healthy church members. And then I'm going to give you the option again to bow out and not repeat it, but if you actually mean it, if you're committed to this goal of being God's instrument of righteousness and leadership in your home, then more loudly, one more time, I will lead my family to be healthy church members.